was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello. 1, 2, 3.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. Yeah!
KBOO's Metal Marathon, the Metal March, is back once again. And that means brand new metal merch. Go to kboo.fm/metal to check out all KBOO's new metal merch featuring exclusive artwork provided by local artists and musicians at Unicron Artworks. This year's Metal Marathon is live on KBOO Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. through Saturday, March 15th at 6 a.m. Get your very own limited edition 2025 Metal March metal merch and listen to every installment of the Metal Marathon at kboo.fm/metal and support metal on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to Let's Talk. Let's Talk is a digital space for students at PCC experiencing disabilities to share their perspectives, ideas, and worldviews in an inclusive and accessible environment. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or positions of Portland Community College, PCC Foundation, or KBOO FM. We broadcast biweekly on our home website, pcc.edu/DCA on Spotify and monthly on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Thank you for joining me on today's podcast, Kenzie. I really am looking forward to this conversation, and I'm hoping we'll have a great time like last time.
Thank you for having me, Amanda. I look forward to this conversation as well.
I felt like I needed to go into that weird intro mode, even though we're not even doing a formal intro. I don't know why I did that.
It's okay. I loved your intros, by the way, the ones you recorded on your own. I think that's a perfect way to go about it if we need to. It is hard to get it going when it is a formal conversation.
Yeah, totally. So I guess to start off, I'm just going to go ahead and ask for introductions like what's your name, preferred pronouns, major/occupation, whether you have ADHD, autism, or both, and how long ago you were diagnosed.
Hi, Mackenzie. My pronouns are they, them. I am a disabled student at PCC in the ASL English interpreting program. I'm also working towards a Deaf Cultural Studies certificate. I also work as a student accessibility advocate for the Office of Accessible and Disability Resources, and I am a membership coordinator for Delta Alpha Pi. It's an honor society for students with disabilities. PCC adopted this chapter a couple years ago, so it's still very new. So if you don't know about it and you're interested in getting involved, please let me know. We are inducting new members very soon. So just wanted to throw that out there because it isn't very well widely recognized. And in terms of ADHD and autism, I was diagnosed with ADHD at age 19. I have not been officially diagnosed with autism, but it has been something I have been actively exploring with my medical and mental health providers and doing a lot of self-research, and is something that I identify with. That's why I'm also on here today to talk about that journey to coming to this place.
Thank you. As for me, my name is Amanda. I use she, her pronouns. I'm finishing up an animal science degree at Oregon State with a pre-veterinary option, and I'm planning to apply to vet school next year. Hopefully I get in this time. And I was actually just diagnosed with autism at age 31. So my diagnosis was very recent. I'm not a part of like the Alpha Delta Pi. I'm sorry if I said that wrong.
Alpha Pi, yeah.
I see it heavily advertised on PCC's website, but I've never really given it much thought. I just don't have the time or mental space for it, to be honest. Kind of mirroring what Mackenzie said, for anyone who's interested, check them out.
On the topic of how I got involved with the student advocacy for disabled students, it actually started with Delta Alpha Pi. Randomly showed up to a meeting because I had talked about it and I had gotten emails about it. And all of a sudden I was elected. I put my name in the ring to be a part of the executive board this past year. And that's how I got into the student advocacy work. So it's been an amazing opportunity to get connected with other disabled students, because that's something I felt a very lack of connection and opportunity for at PCC. So I really am passionate about creating more community and more opportunities for students to connect and be involved. I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for Delta Alpha Pi, and it was just a very random occurrence. So I definitely want to spread the word, because I do think it's important for disabled students to be honored and recognized. And even if you aren't disabled and passionate about disability advocacy, you're welcome to come to meetings, and there is criteria for joining, but you can come to even if you're working towards membership. It's a very welcoming space.
I was just recruited randomly into student advocacy by one of the managers. So going back to the conversation, I apologize. How would you say your assigned gender at birth influenced your ADHD diagnosis?
It's a hard question to answer. I feel like a lot of these questions today are difficult to answer, because it is hard to separate the different pieces of your identity, right? There's that concept of intersectionality. Everything kind of overlaps into one experience. You can't really separate those pieces out. But coming into these diagnoses over the years has really helped me feel a lot more at home and comfortable in myself and my experience, and able to express that to the world. So I think growing up, I've talked about this a lot, of being high masking and given that assigned gender at birth, which for me was female, the world just puts all these expectations on you, and you're spoon-fed all these things that you're supposed to do and supposed to look like and supposed to be. As an autistic person growing up with that, I think there was a lot of comfort to some degree in staying in that space of, okay, these people are telling me I'm a woman, right? Or a girl, and I need to fit into that in order to be accepted by the world. A lot of autistic people have very black and white thinking and need very binary sort of rules to some degree, just to keep themselves safe, because there's so much to navigate in the world. I think there was a lot of safety in that, even though I remember having these conversations with myself about gender as young as 3 years old, like as long as I can remember. I wanted to be one of the boys, but I also wanted to be girly. I just didn't really want to be either. I didn't want to have these expectations put on me, and I didn't think that there was a reason for it, but the world reinforces that of what is acceptable and what is not. I also have been discussing a lot about puberty lately, and just how traumatic puberty is for most people, especially those that have any sort of gender dysphoria or like issues with their assigned gender. I've been reflecting on that period of time a lot, because that's when most of my mental health symptoms started for me, and where things really started to take a turn. And just in general, that time of my life was very traumatic. It really does have to do with the fact that I didn't identify with the expectations and the rules of what was expected of women and females in our society. So when puberty happened, all of a sudden my body is now changing. I have to fit into this thing. I have to find a way to fit into this way of being. It just led to a lot of issues. I was diagnosed with PMDD, which is extremely debilitating. It's so hard to go through the hormone cycles every month, and being extremely suicidal, it irritates all of my sensory sensitivities. It takes away my brain function. It activates a lot of my chronic health issues, and to constantly have to go through these ups and downs every month, it's extremely hard to just do anything. And when you do identify as non-binary and you still have to deal with that every month, it really activates a lot of gender dysphoria as well. in general, assigned gender at birth in relation to diagnoses such as autism, ADHD, can lead to a lot of feelings of being stuck and not really knowing what to do. For me, coming out as queer non-binary happened before I started discussing autism. And that feeling of coming to home within myself, trusting my experience, trusting my feelings, that really led me to the place of digging deeper into my chronic health issues and making that connection and my mental health issues with autism. And then also only seeking out providers that offer gender affirming care. And when you're talking with providers, making sure that they do respect your gender identity and whatever diagnoses that you have. If you ever feel like you leave those appointments and your gut was just like, ew, I feel really disrespected, then get out of there, because it's really important to have that connection to those pieces of your identity, especially when it comes to medical healthcare and mental healthcare.
Thank you. I feel like you actually answered like number three with that too. I didn't realize there was a lot of crossover with these questions when I came up with them because they were separate in my mind, but hearing answers to them, you can answer multiple questions at once. There's no reason not to. I had my own two cents and just responding to what you said. My assigned gender at birth, definitely. I'm cis, binary female, so it definitely did assign my autism process. And I've talked about this on previous podcast episodes. It's because autism and ADHD for the longest time were just thought of as a boy-specific thing or very rarely happened in girls, unless if it was really severe. That it's like I was just not diagnosed when I should have been, despite my mother taking me to three different experts. I'm just never going to forget that and just how they dismissed her and me, how they screwed over, not my entire childhood, but really huge majority of it. Let's all be honest there. I just know if I had been born as a boy, I definitely would have been diagnosed probably before I was in kindergarten based on the stories I've heard about my childhood. In terms of when I started puberty, I'm just going to respond a little bit to what you said because I was kind of going in and out there for a bit as you talked enough. Sorry.
Go for it.
The things I do remember you said, I remember being annoyed when puberty started for me. My breast development was fairly, I want to say moderate, not overly quick, not really sudden, not too slow. I remember being really annoyed when periods started because it's like, great, I have to deal with this now. One thing I really do love about how my mom raised me and my sister is the fact that she never raised us with gender expectations. I promise you, if I had been born a boy or if I had a brother, I would have had the same choice regardless. She never discriminated based on gender. We would have had the same responsibilities regardless. And she never raised me and my sister to be housewives or career women. She wanted us to explore what we wanted and what we were passionate about. And that's just something I think my mom did a really good job on. So I never grew up with those gender expectations or trying to fit into a box just because I was already ostracized by most of my peers and authority figures anyways, that I just never felt those expectations, or maybe they were there and just didn't care. I just never was expected by them the same way a lot of people were, just because of my general indifference towards them. I think you kind of answered this already, but if you wanted to add anything, how would you say your gender identity influences your autism or ADHD? And do you feel like people take your condition more or less seriously because of your gender identity?
This one goes kind of back to what I was talking about with the aspects of your identity being hard to separate, that piece of intersectionality. There really are so many aspects to everybody's individual identity and how they identify culturally and personally in the world. It's really hard to separate those experiences from each other and not just the experience of the person as a whole. There's a ton of layers to that. Let me just read the question again.
I can answer the question first if you want some time.
Okay, hold on. Okay, got it. I think a big piece to my gender identity and coming into home with that was, I think a lot of people also associate gender identity with gender expression, and they don't have to correlate. They are different entities. And so I think the biggest piece for me was I don't try towards any sort of gender expression. I've come into a place where I will do what I'm comfortable doing, comfortable wearing, and just be myself as authentically as possible. And I've noticed out in the world, even when I do, I'm feeling very just, I keep forgetting the word I'm looking for, non-binary. Like, what's the word where you're feeling very like neither feminine nor masculine?
I'm not sure if this is the right word, but the word that comes to mind is ambiguous.
Yeah, sure. I think there's a very similar word in my mind that I'm looking for. But yeah, when I'm feeling very ambiguous and I go out into the world looking that way too, people are just still so quick to gender me as female. And it's kind of frustrating to me in those moments because I don't know why, but it just is. And so along those lines, I feel like when you identify as non-binary, people are just going to question your experiences no matter what. They are like, you don't really know who you are. Everything's kind of like a question. I'm not saying that from the perspective of like the queer community and people that identify as non-binary. I'm talking more about the neurotypical average people who haven't reflected on their experiences with the world being a spectrum. So in general, things are taken less seriously with people that don't understand gender identity, gender expression, ADHD, autism, chronic health conditions, disability, and all of the overlapping intersections of identity. Yeah, I think answers the question, right?
Yeah, like I said, 2 and 3 were pretty similar, so sorry about that. I'm very indifferent to my gender identity because I just see it as I happen to inherit enough biomarkers that I have secondary female characteristics. I just never cared that I'm female, though I identify as female, but I also don't feel like I'm not female. And I'm not sure where this comes from, but I've never had problems separating different parts of my identity at all. I'm really proud of my autism identity. I talk about that a lot more than mainly lean towards women or the fact that I'm female. Like the autism thing is the one I'm the most passionate about. The other parts of me I've mentioned, it's like they're a part of me. I'm not ashamed of them, but I don't feel the need to shout them across the world. And I'm not sure if that comes from the fact that I don't need to justify myself in terms of my gender identity like you do, or I don't feel like I need to get into arguments with people. And it's not like I'm trying to say you're argumentative, but I think that's where it comes from because people are just used to seeing gender as a binary thing in a wider context. You and other non-binary people are probably in a position where you have to essentially justify your existence if that doesn't sound too terrible.
No, I'm happy that you expressed that because I think to some degree, I can relate to what you said as well. There isn't a ton of care deep down about how I display it to the world, how people perceive me, and also about getting it right, because I know there's a ton of people out there who are going to get it wrong. And it's taken me a lot of years to come to a place of accepting my body in taking up space in this world as it is and not wanting to change my body per se, to accept all of the experiences that happen to it. So it's very hard to deny my anatomy and what it does, right? Like I do have female anatomy and a lot of things that I experience are related to that. So it's hard to separate my experience from that. In terms of correcting people when they misgender me, I often don't do that. That really comes down to a lot of rejection, just sensitive dysphoria. And I don't think I should always have to defend myself. Like I said, I know who I am and I feel comfortable in myself. So it doesn't matter that people do misgender me. But when I am gendered correctly, it just feels so amazing. It feels great when people finally do respect you or even ask you about it. I try not to make a big deal. Like I said, my experience and how other people relate to that experience, it doesn't really matter what other people think as long as I feel comfortable in my existence. And lost my train of thought, but go ahead.
Yeah, it kind of relates to the next question. I think what I'm going to do with these, because they're so similar, I'm just going to interweave them into your responses and my responses that actually make for a better conversation.
Totally. And if there's a little piece in those questions where you want to add to the conversation that's going
in
that direction, go ahead and put those pieces in there.
You're listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's Disability Awareness Podcast.
All right. So you mentioned that you were seeking an autism diagnosis or you're heavily researching it. Are you already anticipating your assigned gender at birth is going to influence how doctors, psychiatrists, or other professionals are going to treat you?
That's a good question. And, you know, at the beginning of the year, I was really trying to seek out resources for a formal assessment. I'm at this place in my life where I'm not sure if I will do that formal assessment yet. Just because I found mental health care providers that also identify as queer, autistic, ADHD, and feel very privileged and lucky to have Oregon Health Plan cover that care for me every week. And some things that my doctor has told me this past year has really kind of questioned whether or not I want to do that yet, because it is a huge stressor. It's a big financial cost. And even if you can find resources, there's just a lot of work that goes into making that happen. And one of the things my doctor said was like, she just doesn't doubt that this is a diagnosis for me based on my experiences from young childhood to now, both in regards to physical health and the experience of myself and my brain functioning, however you want to describe it, is that you just have to learn to live well with autism. a big part of my journey, especially since our last conversation, has been researching how to do that and how to learn to live well with autism in this world that is not set up to support us. I've very much come into understanding a lot of my experiences and been able to dig into a lot of those autistic pieces, experiences, and understand how to be myself and honor those aspects of my identity without shame. That was a big thing too, is like, you need to have a meltdown, if you need to stim and pace around, do what you need to do to regulate yourself, to not have shame about it and do it, because it does help regulate you. And I think that nervous system piece is a big part of health. It is with anybody. We live in a very, very high stress world. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're living with autism, that constant activation of your nervous system, your peripheral nervous system. I always forget this.
You're talking about the sensory central input, then yeah, that would be peripheral, you're right.
Yeah. During spring break, I read the book Unmasking Autism. And if anybody out there is even autistic, or you're thinking you might be autistic and you've done a lot of research, like I've done a lot of assessments in different periods of my life, just out of curiosity, like the online assessments. And I've never gotten a result, even if I answer the questions differently, that were neurotypical. That's another piece too. The results of those assessments have very much been, yes, you probably are autistic.
Mind if I jump in here to add my two cents and maybe that'll help you?
Yes, please.
Yeah, like I said, I'm already diagnosed with autism and obviously can't comment on the diagnostic journey. I will say that my journey was very prompt. I literally just went to therapy a couple of times. I think it was just 3 sessions in, and my therapist finally asked me, are you diagnosed with autism? And I was like, well, no, but I suspect I am. And my mother-in-law has definitely brought that up. She's like, you need to get diagnosed. I'm certain you're autistic, but you need an official diagnosis. And I think I mentioned this to you, where I went to 3 appointments and not 1, because that was just standard procedure. She said she immediately knew I was autistic. So I'm not sure what it is about me, but I don't mask at all. I never have. I don't have the patience for it or the mental energy to do it. We just have different responses and coping mechanism. And my responses were to be indifferent or fight.
Mm-hmm.
It gets frustrating though, because it's like I have to almost spell words out just to get my point across. I'm not sure if it's just a miscommunication or if I'm not being clear with what I'm saying, but I've been in so many conversations where I try to explain my needs and people just don't get it. So I find like a tech works really well when trying to explain my needs and how to accommodate me. One thing I do is that I think of real life examples to illustrate a struggle. I think I mentioned this one to you, where it's like climbing up an ice mountain with, I'm not a rock climber.
I think that's the right, I don't know.
They look like pickaxes. I don't know what they're actually called. Point is, you're trying to climb up a sheet of ice on a mountain with very little equipment and you have no backup, and basically someone is up there just telling you to hurry up. I've compared meltdowns to internal volcanoes. For whatever reason, when you use extreme illustrations like that, people at the very least do tend to be more receptive and looks of realization dawn on them. Recently, I explained the dehumanizing process of DAS at Oregon State and how frustrating and traumatizing it was seeking accommodations from them. And when I finally explained to someone, this would be me telling you to turn off your hearing aids because I think you can read my lips well enough, or I think you should be able to sign.
Yeah.
I know that sounds horrible, especially to you. And I apologize about that because I know you're hard of hearing and I would never say this to you and I would never assume this about you. But it's just that dismissive, I think I'm doing you a favor attitude by forcing you to come to my level. When you put something like that into context where it applies to them, that look of realization where they're just realized how ableist they're being towards you finally switches on.
Yeah. I had written about this recently. It's not that I'm asking you to completely change everything for me. I am just asking you to consider that people get to different places in different ways. There has to be some understanding of that. It's not about doing something differently. It's about, I can't remember what I wrote, but you really do have to illustrate the struggle for people. That's the goal, right? To be just like everybody else, to survive in this world. But when you don't have the tools that you need, it's impossible to get there. And I don't think that there is this one way of living. And because anybody else falls outside of that, they're not welcome. And you talked about it's really hard for you to mask. I've always been a very cognitive person, so I've been able to explain my way out of things very well. even though it's not true to my experience. And that was the process of going through mental health care for the past 10 years. Someone pointed it out to me a few years ago, and I was like, you're right. I will talk and cognate myself out of my body experiences. I have never been connected to my body. And I think that ties a lot into gender dysphoria as well. But I've always felt this huge disconnection to my body. I've always wanted to be invisible because the experience of my body in the world did not match my internal experience. And it's always been this huge confusion and making it really hard to navigate the world. So learning how to be present in my body, honoring whatever it's asking for, and understanding that it's probably right because my brain likes to talk me out of anything. So try and listen to that, because when you do ignore your body, it's literally screaming at you and you have to shut down for a few days to honor whatever it is that you're needing. And then you can come back into the world and be able to navigate. But when you're asking me to mask and hide the things that I am needing to do to regulate myself, it takes extraordinary amounts of energy and just everything out of me to be able to do that. And when I'm constantly giving that away to other people, I'm left with nothing for myself, and I don't get to engage in my special interests, and I don't get to feed those parts of me that make me feel whole. In the end, what good is that doing? I feel like I do have a lot to offer the world and I am a valuable person, but when I'm not able to feed those good parts, then I just have to show up and be this very small portion of myself. It's a survival mode. I'm capitalism, a high needs person. I have to have a roof over my head, food, and things that support my sensory needs. So in the end of the day, I have to give myself up for survival mode. And then I'm constantly fighting for my health. It's just this vicious cycle. So yeah.
I totally hear you. All right. So number five actually is a little different than the last few questions. How would you say your autism or ADHD intersects with your gender identity? And would you also say that your ADHD and potential autism become more in touch with your gender identity? Or would you say it made it more difficult?
So I think I touched on that a little bit earlier, but I really came into my gender identity first and then came into my autistic identity. It very much relates back to what I mentioned earlier in terms of the black and white thinking and needing to have these rigid ways of navigating the very confusing world. So with the autistic part, it's very hard when you're lived as this female version for this many years. And now, even though I know that I am non-binary and this is how I want to navigate the world, it can be very hard when you don't have that framework to pull from of what it's like to exist in the world as that person. Representation is a big piece of that. Seeing things throughout your life along the way, like it's okay to be different. I always tell people about the experience of my family growing up. My aunt was lesbian, and I remember being very young and not really understanding that, but not being afraid to ask about it. I remember asking my mom, I was like, is Debbie a boy or a girl? And my mom was like, she's a girl, but she also dates girls. And thinking, that is so cool. I want to be like that. You know what I mean? And just that my family was accepting of that. I'm like, if I didn't have that as a young kid, I wouldn't have discovered that till a little bit later, that acceptance of being yourself. And she actually passed when I was 5. But I still think about her. She's still such a big part of my life. Like, I remember her joy, her smile, and that feeling that she made me feel when I was younger. And I think about representation in general. When we're not exposed to ways of being that are different than what is most broadly accepted in the world, it's very hard to know. I first learned about non-binary gender identity and gender expression when I was a freshman in college. And as soon as I heard about it, I was like, that explains my experience growing up so much. I remember feeling guilty and I was like, I don't want to claim that as my identity because I don't know. I just don't know a lot about it. So then I spent the next 10 years doing this internal reflection and self-analysis and realizing that I am worthy of holding that identity and I am worthy of community. That is hard to navigate still. Even though I identify as non-binary, there's still a lot I have to learn. I also came to this point of understanding with myself during COVID when I was very isolated and I got in touch with myself. So then it's been very hard to get connected with community since COVID. That's also something that isn't talked about a lot. That social anxiety of navigating new communities, new spaces, and when you are chronically ill and constantly worried about getting COVID again because of how much that did impact my life, how much it aggravated a lot of my chronic health and added to the burden that I have to deal with every day. it's hard to find community when you're constantly worried about everything. And the rules of the world are always changing, and that can be another source of social anxiety.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I just really have to comment on something. When you brought up your aunt and how you were exposed to a lesbian relationship when you were a kid, I just really want to respond before I lose the thought. I'm sorry.
Interrupt me whenever, or otherwise I'll just keep going on and on.
Yeah, I feel bad. I'm sorry. I go on and on too, so feel free to interrupt me as well. To be honest, in terms of my sexual preferences or sexuality, I'm kind of reluctant to actually identify because I just don't care. I lean mainly towards women, but I didn't know that for the longest time. I don't remember homophobia in my family at all, but the thing of it is, outside of male-female relationships, wasn't talked about. No other types of relationships were talked about, so I never knew it was a possibility of having a crush on a girl even. Because throughout my formative years, elementary, middle, and high school, I remember being drawn to girls specifically, but because I was never, looking back on it, they probably were crushes. I never thought I even had a crush because I just didn't find anyone attractive. Or at least the idea of attractiveness that I was presented as a kid. Even with my wife, again, I do mainly lean towards women, but because it was never talked about, that realization never really struck me. There was never this big coming out moment in my family, or really anyone. In fact, I think my sister just asked me to confirm at the dinner table one day, and oh yeah, that's a thing with me, and she's like, oh, okay. It just isn't a big deal to me. The end goal is the same when you have a relationship, whether it's intimacy, whether it's sex, why does it actually matter?
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting growing up because I was never exposed to non-binary, though, in different ways through media. My first exposure to non-binary was, have you heard the series Cardcaptor Sakura?
No.
Okay, so it's a Clamp manga and anime. There's this character later on named Ruby who the author point blank states neither male or female, even though they look female, very female. Even when I was reading that, I was like, oh, okay, never thought anything of it. Gay relationships were actually introduced to me through anime, yaoi. And I did see yuri as well, but not until I was older. I don't know why, I just never found them. Not that they were actively hidden from me. Maybe they just weren't as popular in the West. Anyways, point is, never was weird to me, even when I was introduced to it.
There's a couple notes I made in there about never having crushes. I never had crushes growing up, and I didn't really understand why for a very long time. I only had female friends. I just remember being attracted to anybody that was very ambiguous. And if there was ever a question about what someone's gender would be, I was very attracted to that. And then that is a big piece that had me considering attraction in general and previous relationships. I agree with you. I never really cared about labels. It's such a spectrum of experience. I don't think there has to be a certain set of rules. Along the way, I most closely identified pansexual, asexual, demisexual. That spectrum of queerness explains my experience best. But at the same time, it doesn't matter to me. Life happens as life happens. And the obsession with the whole gender thing, same with sexuality, it's all very funny when you think about it in that way. Just let people do what they want to do, because that is what being human is. There's so much cool research about non-binary and gender way beyond our current society that is like, we're just humans, and there is so much variance in how that comes about, especially with intersex. It just doesn't make sense to binary everything.
You're listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's Disability Awareness Podcast.
How would you say your ADHD does intersect with your gender identity? Would you say it makes it easier or harder?
Oh, yeah.
When I say it can mean ADHD or your gender identity, so whichever you feel is more appropriate for the question.
I think it makes it easier. The more that I am able to feel comfortable in my experience, the more comfortable I am in those other parts of myself and allowing to adapt to whatever those parts are needing.
For me, I never questioned my identity in terms of gender, but my autism, I wouldn't say it makes my gender identity clearer or more ambiguous, but I would say it's given me a lot of self-confidence and assurance. I can stand my ground in an argument a lot better.
True, yeah.
I can speak for myself more. Again, it's the confidence. I wouldn't say has anything to do with gender identity, if I'm being totally honest.
Totally. I mentioned this as I was reading Unmasking Autism. The author, I forget their full name, Devin something. Their experience coming into their gender identity and autism is very similar to mine, and I'm sure a lot of people. I think there's such a huge correlation between that journey for the reason of always feeling different. When you are able to work with those pieces of yourself, it becomes easier to be yourself, to stand up for yourself and other people. And yeah.
Definitely. So for question six, I feel like we went into this a little bit, but have you ever questioned your autistic or ADHD needs due to rejection dysphoria or imposter syndrome?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd like to want to talk about any of that. And I think I asked this question, I ended up adding this second part to part question six because of Silver and Limes. But did you ever experience like gender gatekeeping from either cis, trans, or other communities because of your gender identity? Feel free to break down that question any way you want.
So what I had written down here about the first part of that question about rejection dysphoria and imposter syndrome is like when you're living on the edge of anything or when you have identities that you've been masking for so many years, that just becomes a huge piece. I've had these conversations with a lot of people around my hard of hearing identity about not feeling accepted into the hearing world, not feeling accepted into the deaf world, and in terms of autism and ADHD, and then chronic health issues, those disabilities related to chronic health issues. All three of those things very much do this dance in between. Some days, you know, you're able to function better than other days, and constantly questioning your experience, the reality and the validity of your experience, it leads to a lot of imposter syndrome because you do so much to survive. And when you're not able to tend, we might have to come back to that question because I'm losing my ability to articulate. But in terms of rejection sensitive dysphoria, it is so debilitating. Like when you're finally able to speak up about your needs and then have that experience go to absolute, it's so hard to ever want to do that again, to ever speak up for yourself and ask for your needs to be met. I've talked about that a lot in terms of my hard of hearing identity. That was definitely my first different identity besides being female, I guess. As a kid, that was something that was diagnosed for me in first grade and I started receiving accommodations for. So a lot of my experience comes from that. Anytime I would ask someone to accommodate a hearing need and have that not be respected and experiencing a lot of bullying, arrogance, and ignorance around it, it made me feel like I always have to mask as a hearing person. And even if I don't understand anything, I work so hard to make sure that I'm understanding people. Most of the time, I'll walk away from an in-person interaction and only have about half an understanding of what was really going on. So I've always sought out connections with people that are very one-on-one because it's a lot less to navigate and it's a lot easier to engage with someone in that way. But yeah, it's hard to speak up and talk about your needs when it's never been a great experience because it's just traumatic, to be quite honest. Like it goes into your body as a trauma response and it's extremely debilitating. And I remember preparing for this conversation I had to have about accommodations for an entire month. I went nonverbal. I did research for like 3 weeks. I was writing all over my mirrors and whiteboards and notebooks because I have been invalidated so much throughout my life that I wanted to make sure that I was able to say what I needed to say. And even in that moment, I completely blacked out. And I do that in most interactions. I black out and I was like sweating. I was red and it shouldn't have to be this debilitating just to ask for what I need. So anything you want to add about that?
Well, first of all, my experience and honestly, your experience just going to DAS, the dehumanizing process of getting accommodations. Mm-hmm. Feel free to sign up for that podcast because I feel like you and I will have a lot of interesting tidbits there. It's basically going to be an entire session of ripping the DAS process and seeking accommodations to shreds.
Well, not only that, like I've talked about this with a few other advocates and leaders, is I really want to have this space for people to talk about success stories with access and accommodation too. I think it's important to highlight things that have worked for people or like people that have been really accommodating and what that looks like.
I have success strategies that can actually help people increase the likelihood of getting accommodations beyond paperwork. There actually are specific neurotypical strategies that I've discovered and have used, and it works pretty well for the most part. I can't promise it'll work every time. It's like how to work the neurotypical system against them and to our advantage.
Yeah, that's great. I just think it's important to highlight those moments when people didn't have to work so hard to be accommodated. Just having it set up for people that go through different experiences instead of it being a very traumatizing, debilitating process to get those differences to be met in the first place. And I don't know. I think with neurotypical people, they just don't know how to do things differently. And it'd be nice to be able to present people with opportunities to read about
to be honest, it goes back to that really toxic mindset of they think they're doing us a favor by forcing us to be normal. It really does just come back to that. So that's why I use literal examples or use a disability they have against them. Like a lot of people have chronic pain or fatigue, other conditions that they're used to being accommodated for. But when I put it into the context of their own condition, that's when they get light bulbs and that's when they realize they're being ableist. You can present as much reading as they want, but to be honest with you, my experience is that it just goes over their heads or they don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not trying to demoralize you, but I think it's a lot more direct to just lay it on, this is what you're doing, stop.
Yeah.
And going back to the question about rejection dysphoria or imposter syndrome, I can't say I've ever really experienced a rejection dysphoria, honestly, but imposter syndrome, again, I don't think I have ever felt that either because I know who I am. I'm pretty self-confident in who I am. I have a lot of self-assurance of who I am, and my response is just fight. So if someone tries to question my experience, I'm like, who are you to question my experience? You're not in my body. You're not in my head. You're either going to do your job by listening to me and providing accommodations, or we're going to have a problem.
It's funny though, because my response has always been to run and to fawn. You don't have the experience throughout your life of those moments when you were able to stand up for yourself and when it went well. I had sort of mentioned the constant reinforcement of being honest with someone about something, or I'm telling them what I need. I'm being vulnerable and talking about my experience and then to be completely invalidated. Yeah, it makes you never want to talk about it ever again. And it's not fair.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to talk about my natural response to make you feel bad. It's just growing up, I remember the only times I felt truly powerful and listened to was when I screamed and forced people to listen to me. I metaphorically got them down to my level, got them by the throat, and just made them listen to me. And that's when I got results. It didn't always strictly work, but the situation never got worse. And it definitely got to a point of stability whenever I did that. Sometimes the situation actually did improve. Again, I'm not trying to make you feel bad or anyone else feel bad for their natural responses, because those just come from childhood survival techniques. So that's where my response comes from, I guess. Just the fact that the only time I ever really felt powerful was when I did confront someone.
I've done that a lot over the years, but it was never verbally. It was always written out. When I'd feel really frustrated and needing to communicate with someone, I would write them a letter explaining my experience and my feelings. It's always been a good response and very similar in that way of empowering. Because I need that extra time to process things. I'm not always able to do things in the moment. I've always had a hard time with words. So figure out what it is that I really want to say, especially when you're dealing with people that are very defensive. I think a lot of times, especially in regards to autism, it's with the tone of voice and also with what you're actually saying. Like, what I want to say is often not what I mean, just because I'm picking from very limited vocab options in the moment. So tone of voice mixed with intention matching the form of what you're saying. I think writing has always helped me be able to solve those issues. It takes away those aspects that are often misunderstood.
Yeah. Question 7 goes into research a little bit about recent trends with the non-binary community. Are you surprised that the community has an increasing number of its members getting diagnosed with autism or ADHD? Why or why not?
I'm not at all surprised by that. It goes back to something my doctor told me and some reading and research I've done on my own. But one reason I started seeking out autism diagnosis was because my doctor had told me that there is such a high correlation between autistic individuals identifying as non-binary, gender non-conforming, etc., along with a lot of the chronic health issues I've been diagnosed with throughout the years. And I was like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. The notes I had drawn about these questions are things that I already talked about too. So giving people the language frameworks and the story ways to connect to things from a younger age so that people don't have to discover these things later in their life. For myself, there's a high correlation between coming into my gender identity and with my autistic identity as well.
For me, I actually did some research on this question. I forget which study this was from or which article, but this actually sums up why there are so many people with autism and ADHD who are non-binary. I said this earlier, we're just essentially rejected by our peers and authority figures that we're forced to develop our own survival methods and that it just rejects social norms that don't work for us. And a lot of times that does go with gender norms or gender rules or whatever you call it. And of course, we would reject all those BS gender rules. That makes total sense.
And what's especially affirming to me is the fact that I have been questioning this as long as I can remember in terms of my own journey with gender identity. the fact that I've never wanted to follow the rules in that way. A lot of neurodiverse people experience growing up different. It primes you for accepting the difference and not wanting to conform to these things and these systems that just don't make sense, that go against the natural order and ways of the world. I like to turn to nature a lot to explain things and to explain how things work. Obviously, you know, when it's really stormy and the weather is really intense, that's just part of the natural world. Nobody's going to question that. So why do you question when people have moods and things that happen in a similar fashion? Like, it just happens. There's a reason why, but I don't know. Frame it a lot like, when you go against the rules, the laws of nature in general, you're just setting people up for failure and illness, because it just doesn't make sense to go against it, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Another thing I would say about that is not just nature forces, but a lot of other cultures actually have more than two gender identities. I think the most well-known one internationally are Thai ladyboys. I forget what the actual term for them is in Thai, but that's been so well-known and famous that it was featured in the Hangover movie series.
Right. I remember that.
But it's like, why is this weird? So many other cultures throughout history have had third genders or even more than three genders. So I don't know if it's specifically a modern Western society thing where only two genders are really that part of the main conversation, or this just stems back to something else. But I don't know why that's just so hard to conceptualize, because it's not like more than two genders are unique. In fact, right. I think it's actually a lot more common to have more than two genders.
I've been seeing so much about that too. I want to dive into more personal research, but even like pre-Nazi Germany, there's a lot of gender research about the spectrum of gender, the experience of gender outside of the binary of gender, and how a lot of that research was destroyed in World War II.
That's interesting.
But I want to do a little more digging and read more about that in general. But yeah, a lot of indigenous and native cultures and other cultures outside of American Western modern society, they regard people outside of these genders. And it's so frustrating and fascinating to me. I'm like, who decided that there was just one story that was the truth throughout our history in America? And then this is the way it is. Let's hear some other stories, because that's not the only story.
Or take into different cultural norms and just accept the fact that this is a concept that has been proven and it's valid.
And even before I was diagnosed with ADHD, it makes so much sense why people are diagnosed with this, because, damn it, I lost my train of thought.
It's okay.
I know, it's just really frustrating. It happens a lot. I have all these words and thoughts streaming through my head all at one time. And then you go to say it, there's just nothing. It's very frustrating. But anyway, what was I talking about?
I don't know. We were talking about Western modern society and how it's normal for countries outside of that to have three. Like, I brought up Thailand as an example.
Oh, yeah. That. Okay. So there's collectivist cultures and then there's individualist cultures. America is very much an individualist culture, but I can't remember the percentage. I think about 60 or 80% of the world cultures being collectivist, and how that makes a lot more sense in terms of when people are neurodivergent, it becomes about community care and supporting everybody. It's not about individual success. It's about a collective success. It's not focused on clock time. It's on connections between people instead of these rules of the way to do things, professionalism, being on time, all of these. It accepts the variance in experience. And when we have this rigid individualist way and they're like, you can't do this on your own, that means you're a failure. It's like, no, I just don't have the support that I need. And so it becomes a very isolating experience. And that leads to all this mental health. In the end, is it really mental illness? Like, I've been diagnosed with probably 10 or so different mental health diagnoses. It was probably just autism manifesting itself the whole time in meltdowns, shutdowns, you know, nervous system dysregulation, all this stuff, right? And yeah, I don't know. It's frustrating.
I'm not going to comment too heavily on other cultures, but I do want to say something about the collective culture. I'm not sure what you mean by collective in this sense, but I will say other cultures I am familiar with, especially in East Asia, they are collective in the sense that they do value society over the individual, but that creates a lot of toxicity for people with individualistic needs like autism, and it makes them a lot less likely to accommodate. I have a lot of criticism in America in this conversation, obviously, but I will give America credit in the sense that they do at least recognize autism and that there is at least official recognition for accommodations. ADHD is included in that as well. Whereas if you go to countries like the Netherlands, there's an awareness of autism, but they're still like this, not collective. They very much approach accommodations as a blanket method where they just say, no, the individual doesn't matter.
Got it.
At least that was what I personally experienced and heard about when I was in the Netherlands with my wife, but I'm not trying to speak for all of the Netherlands, obviously. Where it's like France, I don't even think autism is still very much recognized as just a disability, you're just invalid kind of thing. So again, I'm not trying to derail your argument, but there's a lot of holes in collective society as well as individualistic ones.
Totally. I also like to say things about that. My worldview is still very small. There's a lot of reasons why I haven't been able to go out and experience different cultures and whatnot.
It's just that there's different weaknesses individual versus collective.
And there always will be. I think that's interesting, the piece you mentioned. You know, a common stereotype of autism is that people are very selfish and only focused on themselves. So I wanted to ask you all about your experience with that throughout your life. Do you feel that stereotype is true, or what is your argument against that?
I guess I'm trying to figure out what you mean by selfish, because we human beings in general are a selfish species. We just are. Can you provide a little more context before I answer?
Yeah, there's just so many stereotypes out there that autistic people are only focused on themselves. Even the sign language signs related to autism are very much related to that sort of internal focus on self and not able to empathize.
I wouldn't say that autistic people are any more selfish than any other human being. It goes back to the fact that there's a lot of invisible social roles we miss, so we respond in ways people aren't really expecting us to respond to. In terms of my experiences with that, I just remember getting into a lot of arguments with people about my reactions to tragedy or just situations with breakups or every other personal things that I'm supposed to have some kind of reaction to. Like, I give an example to someone dying that was a friend of my mom's or connected to her in some way. My condolences are there, but I just don't have a big emotional reaction to it. I don't know the person. And let's see, I think I brought this up before with that organization I wanted to volunteer at, but I decided not to because of this interaction. Honestly, this woman was just trying to harass me. And I'm like, look, I'm autistic. If there was some kind of miscommunication, I said, let's just talk about it. And she sent me an article about an autistic organization member. And this has nothing to do with our conversation. Put on your big girl pants and apologize to me.
Yeah.
It's just, we're responding in a way that people just aren't expecting. And to me, the media aspect of autism, I would say that the characters I've seen are portrayed as selfish. They just react to different things. Like young Sheldon, I think, is a little bit of an exception where, quite frankly, I think the research writing was terrible on that one. And especially because Big Bang went back and forth about whether or not Sheldon was autistic or not. I don't even think they've officially said it or not. They just made him as autistic as possible in young Sheldon, which really bugs the crap out of me.
I don't remember it ever coming out in those shows.
What happened was they just leaned into autism because it was becoming a trend. And that really pisses me off when media does that, because that just means it's a bunch of superficial research probably from Autism Speaks.
Right.
So I don't know if I answered your question, but I would say that the stereotype is that we just overreact rather than that we're selfish. At least that's my interpretation of it. What people miss a lot of times is the fact that we are trying. We actually are very empathetic. And I feel like people don't really have any empathy towards us.
You're listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's Disability Awareness Podcast.
I think sometimes the empathy can get the best of me. I have to shut down. I'm so sensitive to people living around me that I just adopt and absorb their energy. Then I try to accommodate, and then I completely ignore my own needs because I'm so focused on accommodating other people. Living alone definitely helps me with that, but I'm learning to communicate my needs, which is great. It's just a funny thing to me because everybody is focused on themselves. Everybody is selfish. And when you do the work to really understand yourself and your experience in the world, it leads you to be such a better community member and able to show up for other people. I've never really understood why it's a bad thing to be selfish and speak up for your needs.
Well, I think it goes back to that compliance thing. And it's kind of funny that Western culture, especially America, is kind of considered individualistic, because I think we operate on a collective mindset. The only evidence you need to see that is in church groups. There's very much this whole, we have to be the perfect church going at least once a week, white picket fence. We have Bible studies every week or whatever. We have to basically do whatever we have to prove we're good Christians, whatever that looks like in each individual church. Another example is putting family first, where we're just forced to swallow a bunch of trauma issues we have with specific family members for the sake of keeping the peace. And whenever a blowout does happen, it's always on the victim to be the bigger person. And by the way, I hate that. Why is it on the victim to be the bigger person and not the person who actually started it?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think that's funny because, again, human beings as a species are selfish. We just are. There's multiple studies that say that. And second off, there's a difference between being selfish and being evil. Being evil is taking selfish action direct to hurt someone intentionally. speaking up for your needs or doing what you have to survive, that's not selfish. That's not evil. I mean, sorry.
It's okay. I just wanted to bring up the church thing of how I didn't grow up with church. So that's never in my framework when I talk about things. But I think it's interesting how Christianity in particular is so woven into the fabric of American culture. But I don't really associate religion with the larger society of things, even though it very much is. And I always forget about that. So thank you for bringing that up, because that's church culture. That's not American culture. But how are they really separate in the end?
Depends on where you live.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't grow up in church.
My mom tried. It did not work. She tried to raise me in church. It never worked. I just did not care. I was so bored. When someone told me I was going to hell when I was 6 years old, my response was, okay, and walk away.
My parents let us choose what we wanted to do with that on our own.
I know I have said this before, but I always felt like I was in a madhouse in church, whatever you call that room with the pews, where people were touching air with their eyes closed as the guy was singing or talking about something. You're touching air. What are you doing?
It's a very interesting experience.
So I'm just going to ask the last question. What do you want the public to know about your autism or ADHD and how it influences your life as a binary, non-binary person? Or what do you just want the audience to know in general from this conversation? Maybe that would be a better one to end with.
It's always a hard thing. I get very overwhelmed with all the things I want to say. So I want to start out by asking, from this conversation today, for you, what do you think was the most enlightening piece that stuck with you the most? I want to see if that sparks anything for me.
It was definitely how you brought up the language aspect and exposure to childhood, because it kind of actually did make me think about why it took me so long to actually realize I was attracted to women. I never thought about that as a kid. There was never any homophobia despite going to church regularly. At least not language-wise, but I never saw anything outside of heterosexual couples. I didn't know it was an option. And even when I saw relationships like yaoi or gay relationships in anime, it was always that fantasy aspect. I didn't really connect it to real life. It's not that I didn't think it didn't happen in real life. There was just no cognitive jump to real life, if that makes sense. So it's interesting thinking, I just never thought about that aspect in my childhood at all. I think I'm the only queer person on my mom's side of the family. And I don't know, I guess I'm queer. Let's just say for the simplification of this conversation, sure. Did I answer your question or not?
It definitely did. And I tend to black out or have holes in my memory when I'm having conversations. So I do like to gather perspectives from other people. What do you get from our conversation? And what was your perspective from some of the things? But I think that is so important. Yes, I agree. It's having the language and having representation, going back to what you had talked about with the Big Bang Theory and Young Sheldon. If there is going to be things in the media about a particular identity or community, it needs to be a person experiencing that, playing that role, because it's really important for children to have the language and the role models that they can connect to. It leads to people being able to understand their experience from a younger age. And I think it would lead to less mental health issues and navigating puberty and young adulthood in general. I just think about all the people that never learned how to be themselves and how much they take it out on other people. It's just not fair in the long run.
When you say that, are you talking about like closeted gay or lesbian people and heterosexual relationships or married or something?
Yes. Talking about autism, ADHD, mental health, whatever it is that is causing someone to not feel accepted or a part of the world, feeling like that experience is not valid or that they have to accommodate everybody else. I guess what I'm saying is the more that we can expose and have frameworks for people around being different,
more
that our society can heal, grow, and work through a lot of the issues with inequality and inequity that we face on a daily basis. Especially when it comes to people of color, racism, and all the issues around trans. It doesn't make any sense to me. And the whole idea of body autonomy and the government trying to control people's bodies, what is the point of that? Why are people so threatened with people being themselves?
Me.
What?
Oh, I was making a joke. Me, teacher, me. Sorry.
That's okay.
I have an answer to that, actually, and I was just being smarmy a little bit. Sorry.
It's okay.
Just to answer your question and closing this out, to me, when people attack others for their identity, regardless if it's sexuality, gender, religion, race, whatever, it's because they're so insecure with their own identity that they have to project onto others. That
yes.
really is what it comes down to. And the fact that they don't understand how the world is changing and they're left behind feeling more and more irrelevant. So they feel like they have to latch on tighter and tighter and suffocate the very people that are even trying to support them. Because ultimately what happens is people that support their ideas are going to turn on them eventually. Their control is going to eventually trickle down to them.
I think you said that very well. I've been having a lot of thoughts around that lately. So to close it out too, just believe people in their experience and validate them in their experience. If you witness things that oppress people further, just the more you can do individually as a culture to challenge people and ask them why they think that way, the more that we can heal and grow.
Well, thank you very much, Mackenzie. I hope to have you on another podcast coming up.
Yeah, thank you for starting these talks. I think they're super important, and I love to see your process in digging into the reason behind the talks, the questions, and I look forward to future conversations.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability culture. Find more information and resources concerning this episode and others at pcc.edu/DCA. This episode was produced by the Let's Talk Podcast Collective as a collaborative effort between students, the Accessible Education and Disability Resources Department, and the PCC Multimedia Department. We air new episodes bi-weekly on our home website, our Spotify channel, and monthly on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.